some of the kids just the grade above, trying to get a reaction out of them. Or maybe you picture a bunch of young men on a basketball court, elbowing one another and taking some cheap shots just to get some points on the board. It's even possible that it brings to mind the neighborhood stray cat that sneaks into your backyard, knocks over the trash can, and eats last night's table scraps. You picking up what I'm putting down? The knee-jerk reaction to the word scrappy is usually something along the lines of, do whatever it takes to get a leg up, no matter who you might hurt along the way. Forget all that. That's not the way I understand the word at all. I take the word to mean to have grit, to never give up, to be willing to take a guess, even if you don't have all the information. We use the word scrappy so often at Magnolia, and whether you perceive it to be humorous or endearing, it's really a rallying call for us around here. To us, it looks a whole lot different than elbowing or roughhousing. I found this definition in the UrbanDictionary.com, and I really liked it. And I quote, "Someone or something that appears dwarfed by a challenge, but more than compensates for seeming inadequacies through will, persistence, and heart." These three attributes eclipse formal training, in my opinion, any day of the week. Without a doubt, we scrappy types will do whatever it takes when we're going head-to-head with challenges. When others bail, for one reason or another, we're just getting warmed up. To me, that's what it means to be scrappy. I'm not sure how we all came to have these qualities at Magnolia, but one way or another, we all seem to have drunk the Kool-Aid. At least 75% of our workforce are millennials, and for a lot of them, this is their first real job. I'm 42 and almost twice the average age of an employee at our company, so I still have a couple of things to teach these young kids. But it's always been my style to let people figure things out on their own, and there's something inherently scrappy about that. You may not know this, and I guess even if you did, you probably didn't remember, but you only retain about 5% of the content you learn through a lecture unless you pretty quickly go out and either put that content into use or teach someone else what you've just learned. If you do that, you'll likely remember most of it, like close to 90%. That's because when we teach or implement new knowledge immediately after hearing it, we retain it far better. Our brains work harder this way, and we are forced to reason through the logic. It causes us to focus and concentrate in order to solve problems, and this process reinforces what we've just learned. I'm a firm believer that figuring things out on your own is far more effective than being given something on a silver platter, and that belief is at the heart of my personal leadership strategy. I expect our team to dive in headfirst. They don't have time to doggy paddle. We pride ourselves in on-the-job training and problem-solving. I like people who work first and ask questions later. As soon as I get a sense that they're sitting back in their comfort zone, avoiding a challenge, I push them off the ledge. That may sound a little harsh, but people who know my heart understand my intentions behind it. I've got a different take on the whole concept of sink or swim. In my opinion, you win either way. If you swim, that means you're capable. If you sink, that simply means you need more practice. It's less of a, if you don't make it, you aren't good enough mindset, and more of an opportunity to truly assess where you are and what you still need to work on. For the longest time, it was just me and the guys, Shorty, Malesio, and Jose, who worked on all of our renovation projects. But then we hired Kristen to help out with the overall project management. She poured her life into our business. I remember noting the hours she spent working alongside us. The boys and I would be doing hard manual labor, and yet I never questioned whether Kristen was pulling the exact same amount of weight. When she first started, Kristen didn't go through any type of formal job training. She stepped into a world completely unknown and figured out how to get right to work. She's the type of team member who thrives at Magnolia. We've had employees who required a lot of hand-holding and clarification, and those personality types have rarely been able to grow with us. For one reason or another, we always end up going our separate ways. Just about a month after she came on board, I presented Kristen with her first opportunity to take the lead on one of our remodel projects. Right before she got started, I sort of mentioned in passing not to forget to pull some permits. Sounds easy enough for anyone in the construction business, but I was pretty sure she'd have no clue what I was talking about. So she asked a perfectly normal question for someone who'd never done this type of work before. How do I pull a permit? She asked. I gave her a couple of suggestions to get her started and told her she needed to figure it out. This is how people actually learn, folks. If I'd told Kristen exactly how to do it, she would have remembered that information for like a day. But if she actively participated in figuring things out on her own, I knew she'd remember that for a lifetime. I believe this approach pays some pretty hefty dividends. For example, having a bunch of capable employees instead of a bunch of babies. And here's what happened. Kristen called around until she figured out which office she needed to go to. Then she marched herself down to the city offices and asked questions till she was blue in the face. And then she finally pulled her first permit. What would have taken somebody with some experience about an hour took poor Kristen the better part of that day. But she'd made it past step one of the permit pulling process. Check. Sweet Kristen had this job almost across the finish line when the inspector called to set up for the electrical inspection. Pro tip, if there's work being done inside a wall, such as electrical, then the inspection has to take place before you close the wall up, with the drywall or shiplap, whatever material you're using to enclose those walls or ceilings. But how would you know if you're new to a job and no one ever told you? So she had to rewind and open the wall back up to the studs. Kristen will tell you today that she could not have been more frustrated with me throughout that entire project. She'd point out that I knew exactly who to call and what to do, and she's exactly right. I did. But she'll also tell you that her baptism by fire into the world of construction made her tough. She learned fast, and by being forced to figure it out, she not only gained our trust, but she also earned buy-in with most of the contractors in the city. She gained authority by earning it herself, doing the work rather than me offering it to her as a proxy. From my perspective, the point was never to set her up for failure. I'm not one to intentionally hamstring anyone, but I would have much rather she tried and failed than be given the guidebook and never learned how to really figure things out on her own. The reality is, that mistake cost me, but I'm willing to invest in paying twice to have those walls closed up again if the return meant growth for my team. Kristen is just one exceptional example of many talented, scrappy employees who have learned to dive in and swim on their own here at Magnolia. And the fact that our whole team has adopted this way of thinking gives Magnolia a competitive edge. When Joe and I reopened Magnolia Market back in May 2014, we decided that we wanted to establish a culture that challenges and stretches our employees past what they think they can do straight into their discomfort zone. We weren't interested in hiring people who were looking for a fancy job title or a cushy desk job. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just not our way. We specifically look for people who seemed ready and willing to take on the task at hand, no matter what that meant. Unsum-upable. A rabbit trail. For the record, job titles really bug me. They feel like some sort of pat on the back or a symbol of self-importance. I've never had a title, and I hope I never do. I'm not even sure what my business card would say. Chip Gaines Builder? Goat Wrangler? I don't think somebody's value can be bottled up in a job title. I've fought this for a long time. Early on, it was hard to give our team members titles because each one was responsible for so many different tasks that their work couldn't have been summed up in just two or three words. And I liked it that way, just fine. Eventually, of course, I gave in simply because the lack of titles was actually causing a lot of internal and external confusion. But my point here is this. If you want to do well in your work, don't get caught up in the job title mentality. Let your work speak for itself rather than relying on some title that someone else gave you or confining yourself to a job description. It's just so easy to let that title box you in. If you're low man on the totem pole and your title hints at that, then you may put yourself in that box rather than think of ways to go above and beyond, exceeding everybody's expectations. On the other hand, if you're the head honcho with a big title, then you're likely to rest on that. You may settle in and get comfortable, and that's exactly what you don't want if you really want to grow professionally. I should also make mention that never becoming complacent with your position is the best way to make yourself invaluable to whoever you work for. Make yourself irreplaceable to your company, and you will have your choice of titles that can't define you. Being a young business plays into our shoot from the hip, do whatever it takes mentality. But even more than that, we're always innovating and continually looking for new ways to serve our customers. This learn-as-you-go mindset has given our team a competitive advantage that allows us to take on challenges with fresh eyes and sharp instincts. We've looked, but there haven't been a whole lot of experts on what we've jokingly deemed as the, quote, 7 R's of global domination, Asian, end quote. Retail renovations, rentals, real estate, ranching, restaurant business, and reality show. 1, 2, 3, 4. Yep, that's 7. Knocking down our doors to offer any sage advice. We have been forced to figure this stuff out the old-fashioned way. As a result, the lessons we've learned resides not only in our heads, but here in our hearts. And as my girl Kristen will testify, they've changed our lives forever. Some may think that learning as you go sounds like amateur hour. Au contraire, mon frère. Because we didn't learn what won't work, we've found that nothing is impossible. The very landscape of our business has changed drastically over the years, and nothing has come without sacrifice and hard work. It's taken a lot of people a lot of long hours to get all these 7 R's up and running. There are a handful of folks who have been with us since we first opened the shop, and most sane people probably would have jumped ship by now. Maybe that's saying something about Magnolia. But honestly, I think it's really saying something about these individuals. They've seen us through all kinds of growing pains. And in the spirit of Scrappy, we love to look back now and count the number of drastically different positions some of these folks have held. Our founding team members, you see, didn't just pick one responsibility. They picked 4 or 5. Every day they showed up, wore multiple hats, and did the work of an entire team all by themselves. Whatever was needed, they jumped in and they made it happen. In retrospect, even if we'd had a ton of money and could do it all over again, I wouldn't have chosen to hire a different crew to build this beautiful company with. Our people may have lacked experience, and looking back, that was risky. But one thing our people didn't lack was talent. If there was a problem, yo, they solved it. And only true talent can constantly create those types of results. But even more important is the fact that each one of our employees really bought into the spirit of our organization. They carried and carry our vision in their hearts as fiercely as Joe and I do. That's something that would have baffled even the most seasoned headhunter. They've grown up with us, and they've helped the company grow too. Our people enjoy the process, and they refuse to let things fall through the cracks. If there's a hole, they're going to fill it, even if they're already doing their fair share somewhere else. For example, our top executives will be found wearing staff t-shirts on a really busy weekend or helping pack boxes when the warehouse gets slammed. It doesn't matter how the job description reads. At Magnolia, sometimes it's all hands on deck. The people within our organization carry this rare passion and buy-in, and Joe and I do not take that for granted, because you can't teach passion. No salary can draw that out of someone. It's either there or it's not. It's a fire in your belly. I'd go to war any day with this group that we've assembled here in Magnolia. That's the way I feel about this team. I'm well aware of the impact each one has on the bigger picture. As the general of this company, I'm not blind to the fact that without these good people, good, hard-working people packing boxes in the warehouse or hammering away on the job sites, none of this would even be possible. When it's all said and done, they are the people whose will, persistence, and heart give us the best chance for being successful. When something seems insurmountable to most, we shrug because we eat insurmountable for breakfast. Part 3, A Time to Build. Chapter 12, Never Quit Your Daydream. You have to be smart to be funny. It's true. There have been actual studies conducted to prove funny people often have higher IQs. But there are a lot of different types of funny, And honestly, for the punchline to work, it's got to be authentic. Funny in real life is pretty different from funny on TV. As life often works, when I'm being my naturally hilarious self, the cameras are rarely on. Or if they are, the lighting isn't quite right, or a train is making some racket off in the distance. So the producers ask me to do it over so they can get their best shot. As you can imagine, it's easy for naturally funny to get lost somewhere between the third and fourth try. And that's exhausting for me. I love to laugh. I love to joke and prank and be silly to the point of being obnoxious. But doing these things on command for the cameras is a whole entirely different thing. Now, you're probably thinking, wow, poor little Chippy, life is so hard for him, being funny makes him feel tired. I've hesitated to mention this sooner for this very reason. Life isn't hard for me. It never has been. I've had my challenges, sure, but times are not tough. So who the heck am I to be complaining? But bear with me here for a bit so I can make this excellent point. Having to be funny on command feels a whole lot like having a boss. And having a boss is an entrepreneur's nemesis. Lots of people don't want all of the pressure that comes with owning their own small business. It feels like too much of a risk, and they are content to work for the system just so that they can clock out at the end of the day. I'm the opposite. I like to work for myself. I've been doing that since my very first lawn business as a teenager. I'm happy to shoulder all the responsibility and cost if it means not having to answer to somebody else. So what I didn't think through when I signed up for this TV show was that I was really signing up for someone to manage my schedule and basically my entire life. Every day that we're shooting, I'm told where to be and when to be there and what shirt I was supposed to have worn. I'm being bossed for the very first time in my adult life. And who I am runs perpendicular with the reality of having a supervisor or a 9-to-5 schedule. My season 5 beard is a perfect case in point. During our break between seasons, I started growing it out just for fun, basically to see if I could. I've had a few substantial 5 o'clock shadows in the past, but at this point in my life, I was still a beard virgin. When filming started back up, I made the mistake of not shaving my beard and was informed pretty quickly that having the beard on the first day meant I had to keep it until the end of the season for continuity's sake. So you can see how complicated this has gotten. It started out pretty simple. Hey, I'm going to grow a beard out so I can change things up for a few months. Then it was, Chip, you have to keep that beard for 9 more months. So now here I am with a beard on the cover of my book. Not exactly the look I was going for the glossy sleeve of my juicy tell-all. And calm down, everybody. I hear the feedback loud and clear. Trust me, however much you hate this beard, I hate it more. I have spent summers pounding the pavement, selling books door to door. I've trimmed trees. I've mowed acres of grass from dawn till dusk in the hot Texas sun. Though not as hot as selling fireworks from a plywood stand during a roasting southern July. I built retaining walls that held up entire hillsides from nothing and constructed new homes from scratch. I have come home at the end of the day weighing less than when I left in the morning, just from the copious amounts of water weight I'd lost through sweating. Perspiration and aching muscles, they don't bother me one bit. In fact, if I haven't worn myself out at the end of the day, if I don't come home with bruises or scratches, then I just don't feel right. I feel unsettled, like I've shorthanded myself somehow. But when I've physically worked hard, it feels like a day well spent, and I've loved every minute of it. But even after all that manual labor, making a TV show is the most exhausting job I've ever had. And the reality is, it's not grueling work, at least not physically. It's also not rocket science. It shouldn't drain me to the extent that it does. The irony is that on camera, it appears that I'm just goofing off, playing, really, when in reality, it's the hardest work I do. I feel enormous amounts of guilt for fessing up to all this, because no matter how emotionally taxing this show might be, it still has been the opportunity of a lifetime for Joe and me. Every day, we're grateful. Fixer Upper has allowed us to pursue so many dreams, so many things that we are truly passionate about. I never want to lose sight of that, even for a second. But that doesn't mean it's always easy or natural for me to do this show. And by the way, Jo loves it. She's a natural. She has no problem sticking with the schedule, and when the cameras start rolling, she is truly mesmerizing to watch. Some people are just made for the camera. I love to be on set and watch her come alive in her element. It's one of my favorite things to do, unless you include the times when I get to just come in and mess with her while she's working. Now that I really do sincerely enjoy. But the truth is, I'm a builder. I'm a contractor. I don't just play one on TV. I love nothing more than being with my team and making good progress on the job site. And our filming schedule can be pretty disruptive to both the workflow of our construction business and my natural work rhythms. Jo and I show up at a project ready to roll up our sleeves and get after it. And right as we get acclimated to what house we're working on and all of the nuances and the specific plans and the design details associated with it, we're tapped on the shoulder, notified that it's time to move on to get the next shot. And that's just how television works. On top of that is the enormous workload that the show generates. We renovate about 17 homes per season, each of which is filmed within a 9-month time span. And that's just the television portion of our construction business. Off the air, we're almost always doing interesting projects in addition. Now, in real life, if you were to hire a contractor to come in and do any type of project, that alone could take up to 9 months just to complete. So you can only imagine the amount of jumping around Jo and I do in order to keep tabs on things. Most people in the TV industry probably sought out a career in showbiz. They were formally trained, or at least maybe did theater in high school or college. Then they auditioned for the parts that they wanted. But Jo and I kind of fell into this TV thing by accident. Hey guys, want a TV show? All right. Maybe that's why audiences resonate with us. We don't seem so slick because we're not. We don't use a lot of hair and makeup or a wardrobe team like most of our counterparts do on TV. Jo puts on blush and eye makeup and such in the parking lot just before we jump out to film. And as for me, you can just forget it. No makeup. No skinny jeans. No sandals. Just the same old clothes I was wearing before we got into all this. So in a sense, what you see of me on Fixer Upper is what you get. But being a TV personality has never been a dream of mine. Certainly not a passion. Or what I ever considered to be my life's work. We were created to live passionately, all of us, no matter our personality type or circumstances. The human heart was made to swell and jump and stir. That's a fact. It took me a while to figure out what makes my heart feel that way, but that is perhaps one of the most crucial things to know about oneself. What makes you want to jump out of bed in the morning? What puts a smile on your face, the kind you can't wipe off even if you tried? What fascinates you? What motivates you, overwhelms you in the very best sense? If you don't know, I suggest not wasting one more single day until you find out. Here's what it looks like for me. So far as work goes, my favorite part of all this is the working part. I mean actual physical labor, the kind that makes you tired and sweaty. Getting up at 4 a.m. to tend to the farm while the world is quiet, feeding the animals, mucking stalls, gathering eggs, filling water troughs, checking fences, letting animals out in the field, is a high point to my day. Maybe it's because I'm task-oriented and I like seeing something through from start to finish. Maybe I just love being outdoors. I can't be sure exactly what it is about this kind of work that I love, but I know for sure that I love it. It probably would be wiser, from a time management standpoint, if I hired a crew to take care of the farm so I could get a little more rest. But the thing is, when I start my mornings out there, I'm more productive for the rest of the day. That's God's own truth. Maybe it's because my farm chores guarantee that every day I have at least 2 hours to myself. No texts, no emails, phone calls or meetings. No producers sending me pictures of the shirt that I was supposed to be wearing. Though farm chores and construction work are the most physically demanding labor that I currently do, they feel like recess to me. And there's something really beautiful about work that feels like play. The way I see it, there's work, and then there's work. And there's a big difference between your work and your job. A job is a task done for an agreed-upon price, and work is the effort directed toward accomplishing a goal. See what I mean? A job is something you do for money. Your life's work is done for a bigger purpose, to fulfill a calling or a dream. And when you manage to find that kind of work, that's when it starts to feel like play. I want that for you, and for me too. Don't allow yourself to get stuck grinding away on the job piece and lose sight of the work piece, the one that truly matters. There's nothing admirable or respectable about laying yourself down day in and day out for a job you hate, not if you have a choice. Maybe you can't up and quit the job you hate. I understand that there are extenuating circumstances that can prevent you from being able to take that leap. But if you are sticking it out because of fear or passivity, there's nothing heroic about that. Do work that matters to you. Now, if you're like most people, you're somewhere in the middle. What you're doing to support yourself may not be the thing you feel like you were born to do, but it's not total drudgery either. I get that you might not love every part of your job. I don't think anyone does. As I've said, I don't love every aspect of running Magnolia or doing Fixer Upper. But I know from experience that if you can get to a place where you at least feel passionate about some of the work, the job part will become a lot more bearable. Vocation is a powerful thing. Don't let it just happen to you. Chase after it. Even if right now chasing feels a whole lot more like limping. You're going to spend approximately 92,000 hours of your life working, so figure out what drives you, and then run, don't walk, in the direction of making real, fulfilling work out of that dream. And even if that's not feasible right now, carve out a chunk of your day, and then your week, and then your life for the things that fill you up. Perhaps you can't quit your day job, and I understand that, but don't ever quit your daydream. Chapter 13, Season Finale. When left to our own devices, Joe and I will literally work ourselves to death. Even before we knew each other, we had unusually high capacities for work, but together, that's grown exponentially. People ask us every day, how in the heck do you guys do it all? We just kind of stare at each other and shrug our shoulders. It obviously doesn't have anything to do with our self-care habits, because for the most part, our self-care habits are terrible. Joe and I don't eat right, we don't exercise, and we're awful at getting a good night's rest. Basically, all we need to do is take up smoking to be the go-to guides for what not to do. Or the proof may be in the pudding, and our lifestyle is, in fact, the thing that's responsible for this capacity of ours. But while we Gaineses may be workhorses, we're also pretty clear on what our limitations are. Joanna and I have concluded that we can only really do two things well at one time. And I'm not talking about the rubbing your stomach while patting yourself on the head kind of things. I'm talking about big things. For example, it wouldn't be wise for either one of us to run for public office while researching molecular disintegration, while also writing a screenplay for an epic docudrama, all while raising our young family. You know? That wouldn't be smart for us. That would be our version of spreading ourselves too thin. It's not that we can't juggle more than two things at once. In fact, by definition, there must be at least three things in play to even call it juggling. And we're definitely capable of doing it. We just don't do it well. Some things eventually have to give. And to be honest, we're just about to that point. Presently, three big things absorb my thoughts and all of my time. These major responsibilities affect my ability to sleep, and they steal from my peace of mind. Each is important now. Each is worthwhile. And each is something that can't succeed without Joanna and my personal involvement. Here they are in real time. Number one, we're strengthening our marriage every single day, which takes real time and effort, and we're raising four great kids who we couldn't be prouder of. Number two, we're running a mid-sized business with multiple components called Magnolia. Number three, we're filming a hot cable television show about the ups and downs of designing and renovating homes. The reality is that we can't afford to neglect a single one of these commitments. They're all opportunities of a lifetime, really, and none of them deserves our second best. And each feels like a huge responsibility with far-reaching implications. Number one, our marriage and family is by far the most important. There's honestly not even a close second. That is our non-negotiable. No one else in the world can raise our babies, and no one can better love and support my wife. No matter how successful I may be at priorities 2 through 100 in my life, at the end of the day, for me, if I didn't get number one right, I failed. Number two is our work. We've committed ourselves to Magnolia businesses and their employees. And as a young company, it needs our direct involvement. It's going to mature. We're hiring the right people, building great teams, and getting the right infrastructure in place. But it's simply just too early to take ourselves out of the equation. I dream of the day when Joe and I are chairman of the board and not actually involved with the day-to-day operations. When our team will come to us with only high-level concerns, looking for counsel and direction. But the reality is that day is in the future. For now, Magnolia still needs our vision and our leadership and our day-to-day presence. As for number three, the bottom line here is there's just not anyone handsome enough or rugged enough to stand in for me, and there's certainly no one hot enough to replace Joe, so you guessed it, only we can do that job too. These past several years have been such a mind-blowing season of blessing for us. They have also been a very real struggle. I've been in this lengthy internal wrestling match, trying to understand and prioritize these three main priorities while also fending off all the other big things that compete for my time. Who deserves the best of me? Which one gets the bulk of my passion and energy? And which, in turn, gets what amounts to be the leftovers? In the beginning, of course, we could all handle all three because everything was still pretty small. The shop had just opened back. The show was just getting started. Nobody really knew our names or our faces yet. And we honestly didn't even know if the thing was going to take off or not. Even the babies were small back then. However, before we knew it, the show had become a huge success and undoubtedly gave our business a major lift, which we are so thankful for. We grew bigger and have been afforded more opportunities than we could have ever imagined without this show. Success is such a complicated thing. All successful people want to be able to take at least some credit for their success, but successful people also struggle in their heart of hearts about whether it was just luck, or being in the right place at the right time, or something else. Additionally, as a believer, I find myself wondering, why me? Why did God pick me out of all people? And most of all, these days I find myself wondering, what comes next? Are you familiar with Newton's Cradle? It's that little desk toy with the row of metal balls all hanging from strings that hit each other from one end to the next when you pull it back and you let it go. Newton's Cradle is more than just a toy, actually. It demonstrates a principle of physics first described by Sir Isaac Newton in the 17th century, the law of conservation of momentum. This law basically states that something moving in a uniform speed and direction will continue in that same motion until something comes and forces it to change direction. I don't know if you've ever messed with one of these devices, but they are absolutely mesmerizing. Once those silver balls start swinging, they keep clicking away back and forth for quite a while until something stops them, whether it's their own friction or someone's hand. That toy reminds me of Joe and me. We will just go and go and go with no brakes until something knocks us in a different direction. In today's world, this tendency is sometimes viewed as a strength, but honestly, I'm not really proud of it. In fact, I find it a bit unsettling. We're currently shooting season 5 of Fixer Upper just as we have the previous 4. We're in it. We're focused. We do this forever because, you know, momentum. For a long time, in the midst of the steady swing of marriage and babies, the business and filming, Joe and I didn't really stop and take notice that we were just getting by rather than giving each other our very best. Against our better judgment, we told ourselves that we've got this, that we could, in fact, keep juggling these three big priorities, that they weren't really that big. But guess what? We didn't have it. It was really easy for us to feel like we could do it all when the show and the business were at their early stages, but the bigger things got, and they got big fast, the less energy we had to allocate to all three. So much time was being allocated to filming that the details of the business were really slipping. But it was really easy for us to fall into that illusion that the business was doing just fine with a third of our attention, because after all, candle sales were up. Joe and I were going about our lives in a normal Newton's Cradle type of way. until I was knocked off pace into the opposite direction by a tweet. And didn't we all know that a tweet would ultimately end life as we all know it? I for sure had that sense. The tweet that changed everything. I swear my tombstone's gonna read, "Death by tweet." Look, I'm a serious Twitter aficionado. Wanna make my day? Wanna hurt my feelings? All you have to do is tweet at me. Those little 140 character messages can be like hugs and sometimes daggers to the heart. So I got this particular tweet at approximately 2 a.m. one night when I was finding sleep particularly elusive. The tweet was from a customer who hadn't received their order yet. It read, "Hey, at Chipper Gaines, it's been 3 weeks and I still haven't gotten my wreath. What's up?" I wasn't happy about that, of course, but I tried to shake it off, knowing that there really wasn't anything I could do about it right then, and this was going to have to wait till morning anyway. But no luck. I was up all night dwelling on that tweet. And Joe and I were scheduled to film at one of the projects we were working on the next morning, hair combed by 8 o'clock sharp. Midway through our second shot of the day, I started to get this weird, not-so-good fuzzy feeling. I thought maybe I was just exhausted or maybe dehydrated, something like that. So I found a nice place to sit down to let my mind settle a bit. But as I was sitting there, all of a sudden, I was overwhelmed by a single thought. What am I doing here? A simple tweet about a late order from an online store was all it took for me to realize that I needed to recalibrate. I felt this overwhelming compulsion to walk off this shoot and head straight to our company's shipping warehouse. In my mind, I knew that I needed to be up there packing orders and helping get those packages out right. We were behind in shipping dates, and this no longer felt like a distant problem that others surely would be attending to. This was my problem, and I needed to be a part of the solution. Who else but me should be figuring out what was ailing my growing business? And who else other than me should be ensuring that we move beyond each and every one of these mistakes? In the same instant, it felt like Mexico all over again, like I was off chasing something trivial instead of taking care of my primary responsibilities. My construction company was a well-oiled machine. We had been doing what we were doing for nearly 2 decades now, but the retail side of our business was still just getting its feet under it. And it was suffering the consequences of my absence. In that moment, something shifted in me. Suddenly filming this TV show looked a whole lot like the job that had seduced me into giving my precious time that I had always promised would be reserved for my true loves, my family, and my businesses. How had this side gig found its way into competing with the very things that meant more to me than anything in the world? It's crazy how sometimes it takes something so tiny to knock you off your steady pendulum swing into a completely different trajectory. That one symbolic tweet made me realize that although everything seemed to be going fine, the company really did need my daily leadership. That tweet-fueled revelation also brought me to realize that Joe and I were tired. Don't take this to mean that we aren't doing well as a couple. That's definitely not the case. I'd even go as far to say that we're doing better and maybe are more in love today than we've ever been. Joanna is my partner in my family, in my business, and just generally in life. And that is never going to change for us. But pure long-term exhaustion can change a person, or two persons for that matter. We had been driving so hard for so long now, and I had this sense that if I keep my foot on the gas, we might be heading for certain disaster. I had to admit that I'm already feeling it. Even the most menial tasks feel draining these days. I know that Joe is worn out too, but she's just naturally better at pressing on and often doesn't even realize how tired she is until she's completely crashed. Have you guessed what I'm getting at here? You probably have, but let me be direct. We haven't said the words out loud to many folks yet. But as I read them now, they feel more real than ever. We have decided to leave the show. It's mile 19 of this marathon that we're running, and I have hit the infamous wall. I can feel my body breaking down, and my mind is literally arguing with my heart. telling me that it's impossible for me to even finish. It's funny what your mind will tell you and what you'll believe when you're totally exhausted. But the end of this race called Fixer Upper is drawing near. I can see the finish line off in the distance, and I do want to finish well. It's the only way I know how to do it. I learned a long time ago that if you ever consider quitting, it's already too late. Because when things get tough, and I mean really tough, you've already quit even though you didn't know it yet. So we're not quitting the race in the middle, I can guarantee you that. But we are looking ahead to the end of our run and wondering, what then? It almost seems nonsensical to walk away from this miraculous gift from God, from the very thing that brought the world to our doorsteps here in Waco, Texas. I understand that I've lapsed into new heights of melodrama, but I feel a little bit like the biblical patriarch Abraham, standing there at his makeshift altar, arms around his precious son, facing the enormous sacrifice he believes he is being called to make. The Lord gives and the Lord takes away, and in all things we are to bless him. Obviously, leaving a television show behind is not even in the same stratosphere as sacrificing one son. And I totally understand I'm no Abraham. And yet, I feel as though Joanne and I have gotten a small taste of what that struggle might look like. We have wrestled every which way with this decision, and we still, in the end, come up to the same conclusion. It's time we lay this down. Conventional wisdom would say that we are insane to even consider walking away now, and I'd be happy to list out the many reasons why this is true. I have every last one of these memorized as I turn them around and around in my head, usually in the middle of the night. First of all, the show has been a huge hit. We are constantly one of the top shows in all of cable television, and trust me, nobody saw that coming. All of us have been completely amazed at Fixer Upper's success. Second, Fixer Upper has been really, really good for our business. Joe and I have always been business people. That's who we are. That's what we do. And that's how we think. Our business has always been a central part of our story, and it is only natural for it to be a central part of the show. It was the fact that Joanna was actually a designer, and I was a legitimate contractor that landed us the show in the first place. This authenticity seemed novel to the production company, and they pitched the show with that as the core concept. If Waco is a character on the show, then Magnolia definitely is. We didn't start this business to capitalize on the Fixer Upper audience, of course. And as you know, Magnolia's home remodeling company preceded Fixer Upper by almost 13 years, and Joe had been selling home decor for a decade before the show even aired. But did the show grow these businesses? Absolutely. Fixer Upper is like a long, free infomercial about Magnolia every Tuesday night. So why would anyone walk away from a free advertising machine in the middle of establishing a new brand? Who in their right minds would give that up? Third, and most important, we are about 500 Magnolia employees strong at this point. That number typically shocks people, and that may be because we work really hard at keeping this place feeling like a mom-and-pop shop. No matter how big our business might grow, we never want to lose that feeling. And to me, these employees aren't just a number. They are the very lifeblood of this whole deal. Even though I don't know the name of every single person we employ like I used to, I carry each one of them with me. I feel an enormous amount of responsibility for each of their livelihoods. I think about their spouses and their children. I care about their health, their mortgages, their debts, and most of all, I think about their dreams and what their futures might look like. We have built this amazing team of beautiful folks who show up every day and work their hearts out on our behalf. And in stepping away from the show, we are stepping into an unknown with all of them on our shoulders. We have no idea what this all looks like once the screen goes dark. In all of the wrestling that we did over whether or not we should stop doing Fixer Upper, the praying and seeking God, what really kept me up at night was wondering how leaving might affect all these people, the people who risked everything going with us. All this is to say that, yes, we know we might be crazy to leave the show now, but we've been called crazy before. The decision to leave Fixer Upper has not been easy, and we are acutely aware of what the implications might be, but we still believe in our hearts this is what we're supposed to do. We will forever be thankful for HGTV for taking a risk on us. Back when we began, that's what we were, a big risk. Pretty far outside the box of the quote-unquote talent they usually hired. They have been good partners to us, and we will always be so proud of this beautiful thing that we created together. HGTV has been an amazing place to learn the ins and outs of television. We have received the education of a lifetime, and we wouldn't trade that for the world. HGTV also provided us with a platform to share our perspective, and we are grateful for that too. In an industry that doesn't often show authentically happy marriages, we have loved getting to go in front of the cameras and laugh and hug and argue, collaborate, and really cheer each other on. These are some of the things that we do with or without the cameras rolling. But getting to show people this version of marriage has truly been one of the favorite parts to all this. And sure, staying on the show for a few more years makes all the sense in the world. It's at the height of its popularity, breaking network and cable records, and we have a full spectrum of offers coming our way. A couple more years could make all the difference in the world. But at every step of the way, there'll be another ante, another all-in required of us. Who knows where it all would end? It's easy to talk a big game when you have nothing on the line. It's a lot harder to put your money where your mouth is when it might cost you everything. In a way, we've never had more at stake. This decision may severely affect our finances as well as our opportunities. What's ours for the taking right now may be expired when we come back around. If we leave now, there's no guarantee that anyone will even be calling us tomorrow. Even so, there is only one way forward for us, and we're all right with that. We probably don't see this the way the rest of the world does. If things stop selling, if the offers stop coming in, maybe even our money dwindles away. I couldn't care less. Seriously, if you don't hear anything in this entire book, hear this. I don't care enough about my personal finances to compromise my family or their well-being. We've had empty pockets before, and that's nothing we can't take on again. The education Joe and I have gotten through this process of making this decision has changed everything. What we knew going into this opportunity years ago made us a force to be reckoned with. But armed with what we know now, I feel like we are literally unstoppable. And when the day comes when we can take a step back from Magnolia, there will still be many things that we're excited to explore. There will be new challenges to conquer, new facets of society to disrupt, and there may even be a show or two in our future. Who knows? Joe has always loved the medium of television. And maybe I'd love it more if I didn't feel like my hands were already committed to raising my beautiful family and to building this amazing company. For now, though, I'm committed to doing two things well, not three. Because in the end, if my family isn't at its best and my marriage isn't at its absolute strongest, then I will move mountains to make those things right. Joe and I just need a break. We have been running this marathon together that just never seems to end. And we need to take some time, catch our breath, and focus on our family and these businesses. It's difficult to give your heart and soul to something that no longer inspires you. And for us, that's just simply the show. It has been beautiful and wonderful. And our fifth final season is our favorite yet, even if getting to the finish line has been quite the struggle. But I know for sure that we've left it all out on the field. Every bit of love and care that we could have given these beautiful homes and these wonderful families, we've given it away. We have no regrets and nothing left to give on that front. There's no question that this show was a miracle. From the very beginning, we have seen the hands of God all over it. But we are confident that it never was meant to be the end goal for us, but rather a means to the end. We are attempting to impart something important and meaningful on planet Earth, far beyond simple home decor and home renovations. And the show has given us a powerful platform for those goals, as well as enabling Magnolia to begin to do the beautiful things that it was created to do. But closing the show does not mean we're going to stop moving towards those goals, or trusting God to show us what's next for us. The thing about walking closely with God is that it has to be a minute-by-minute, day-by-day kind of relationship. No formula can ever suffice. You have to keep listening, keep following, keep being willing to act and to move on when it's time. If you'll remember, the manna from heaven that God sent to sustain the people of Israel in the desert was only good for one day. It was miraculous, but it also came with an expiration date. And so do many of God's blessings in this life. The fact that something is from God does not mean it has to be forever. The Lord gives, and remember, the Lord sometimes takes away. One of the things I've learned about God in my 42 years is that He loves to obliterate the boxes that we put Him in. There's no way to predict the way He speaks to us or leads us. In this case, He spoke to me through a tweet. And in an instant, I knew our miracle had served its purpose. The lessons were learned. The blessings, they were distributed. It was time to let go of this beautiful experience that we all call fixer-upper. God had given us this gift that I knew was ours to unwrap and to enjoy. Even as we were being stretched by juggling those three major priorities in our lives, He covered my family and our business. They are both doing so well in fact, I can only attribute their state to the miraculous. But if I were to continue on with the show now, I know that I would be taking things into my own hands. God's grace lasts as long as it's required, but when the grace and the peace starts to go, for me, that's a good time to evaluate if God is still in what you're doing. When I did just that, it became crazy clear to me that if I continued on, too scared to let go of my aging miracle, I'd risk losing one of the two commitments that I have been tasked with taking care of for the rest of my life. One of these commitments is our business. Our ongoing prayers that when people visit Magnolia here in Waco, Texas, or even receive a package from us on their doorstep, they will be inspired to go love their own homes even more. And behind that, to pour more love into their families and even their own lives. We really do want this company to be a vehicle of hope for us here on the earth. And then, of course, my one true desire is to love my beautiful wife and to raise these babies well. I want to give them each the best possible chance of making it. I want them full of courage and confidence and compassion. And if I get this one thing right, I won't have one thing else to prove. I have no clue what the future holds at this point. God surely has a few more surprises up His sleeve for us. Yet I refuse to box Him up. I refuse to limit what our story might look like in the months and years to come. I can say no to everything the world offers, but any gift God has for me, now I'm taking that. Chapter 14, Team of Rivals. You in the mood for a good parable? Good. Let's say that I'm digging a ditch. The day is young, the sun's hot, and there's plenty of hole left to dig. And then some random guy walks past and offers to give you a hand. What's my answer? It's yes. No pondering, no questions, just yes. In a situation like that, it seems crazy to me to stop and consider the potential helper's pastime or belief systems. Say he practices homeopathic medicine, or chases after tornadoes, or believes in alien life forms. What business is that of mine? I'm just thrilled to have the extra set of hands helping me out. When you're busy getting real work done, being choosy about who you're willing to work alongside seems like a pretty big luxury to me. Now, if you're in this ditch with him all day, there's bound to be some time to talk. So in the case of the storm chaser, I ask him to share his thoughts about inclement weather. And since he's got plenty of time, I take advantage of the opportunity to learn about what he does and why he's so passionate about it. I begin to understand a little bit of what makes him tick. And I even learn something of where he comes from and where he's been. There's a good chance that this tornado chaser, or maybe the alien-loving, homeopathic-practicing amateur ditch digger, has something to say that I might need to hear. I'm a pretty opinionated guy, but I'd try to just listen. And not the kind of listening where I wait for the lull in his monologue just so that I can jump in so that it'd be my turn to talk. Instead, I try to really listen, past the what, and maybe to the why. Because it's so hard to learn when I'm sure that I already know all the answers. Maybe this new acquaintance never gets around to asking about me, what I think about or what I believe in, the future that I might hope for. He doesn't think to ask, or maybe he doesn't even care to know. Then again, he may be genuinely interested in just getting to know me after all. If he asks, I start with some really easy stuff, the names and ages of my kids, the town I grew up in. But as the day goes on, eventually there's nowhere else to go but straight to the matters of the heart. Turns out, the ditch that we're talking about is the length of the divide between us, the span of our differences. And there's so far to go before sundown. As we keep on digging, if he lets me, I'll eventually share what keeps me up at night, the things that make my head a bit dizzy because I love them so much, and the horrible, awful stuff that makes my blood just run cold. I'm a talker, and I could go on and on about these things, really for some time, but I decide to hold back. This gentleman has already been so selfless in laboring alongside me that I don't need to talk his ear off. When I picture this event in my mind's eye, we look pretty different. Different height, different hair color, our eyes are a different color, even our skin tones. When he speaks, it's in an accent that I can't quite make out. All I know is that in this scenario, I'm not like him one bit, and he's not like me, and that's more than okay. In fact, it's completely irrelevant. Had he been just like me, the work wouldn't have gotten done any quicker. In fact, early on in this example, he identifies a way that we can work even smarter. Now listen, I've been digging ditches for some time now, and I don't know anyone who does it the way he's suggesting, but it seems a thoughtful approach, so we say, let's try it. And it turns out it saves us several hours off the entire workload. So I'm sure thankful for the fresh eyes he brought to this job. By day's end, we have spanned this entire divide. And without his help, it would have taken me an entire second full day of hard labor to get where we stand today. I express my gratitude, but there's no money in my pockets to pay for his work. And he maintains that he would have refused it anyway. So I decide to invite him to my home that night for dinner. It's a humble meal, but everything we have to offer we gladly share. And it isn't until midway through the meal that he really begins to open up. He shares his story, even some of the difficult parts. And I'm pleasantly surprised by his vulnerability. His words pour out like they've been bottled up for years, waiting on an invitation to just share. Some of his words are honestly hard to hear. He sees the world completely differently than I do, and several times I have to bite my tongue to keep from interrupting. But I hear him out, and eventually I manage to see things from his perspective. We talk until well after midnight. When I walk him out, we shake hands in parting and embrace. Then he's gone. Had I not invited him to dig that ditch with me, really, had he not offered, I never would have known this man. Not his name, not his story, certainly not his point of view. And I know I would have been worse off for it. In the time that it took me to dig that ditch, he went from a stranger to a co-worker to then a teacher and a friend. It's easy to judge other people's character or snub or stiff-arm them before we ever even get to know them, know what makes them tick or where they're coming from. But when you spend hours working hard towards a common goal with someone, your differences and your preferences tend to fall by the wayside. Being down in that ditch makes a way for us to gain a new respect for one another. It makes space to really listen. If I populate my life with people just like me, my world's going to be pretty small indeed. Maybe just one person deep in every direction. If there are no opposing views, no fresh vantage points, then there is no stretching beyond myself, no growth, and no change. Some people don't want to deal with the inevitable growing pains that accompanies change. They will choose comfort over confrontation any day of the week. This kind of thinking really scares me. Biology, and of course, legendary football coach Lou Holtz, actually teaches that we're either growing, that is changing, or we're dying. And I'm not about to atrophy due to some misguided sense of self-preservation or fear of change. As Joe and I move through this crazy new life as semi-celebrities, well-meaning people are always telling us, please don't change. And I'm pretty sure that what they're saying is that they don't want us to lose our authenticity. And I get that for sure. And yet I wince each time somebody says that to us. Folks, listen, we have changed and we are changing and we about to change some more. It is quite literally impossible to build a company or go on national television.